Well, good evening. Welcome back to our series on the book of Romans, talking about what Christianity is really about, kind of getting back to the heart of Christianity. I was in Washington, D.C. for the inauguration this past weekend, and it was a rowdy crowd. I'll just say that. It was a rowdy crowd. And I was telling Laura that, you know, it was God, America, and Donald Trump, but not always in that order. And a lot of holy water being thrown on a lot of things. And so I'm great for people's exuberance, but I thought, yeah, we just need to make sure that we know what Christianity is really about. So I'm glad we're doing this series. Let me say a prayer for us and we'll jump in. Lord, thank you for the mercies and the blessings you've given to us. I do pray for all in this sound of my voice, those who are grieving, I pray for your comfort. And those who need healing, I pray for your touch, Lord. I pray, Lord, that we would know deeply how much you love us and that you would give us faith to trust you in every circumstance. I do pray for our nation, Lord, that we would be a beacon of justice, that we would be a beacon of right in the world. And I pray, Lord, you would give our leaders wisdom to know the way forward. I pray, Father, for peace in the Middle East. And I pray, Lord, that you can do what seems impossible to us. We love you and we thank you in Christ's name. Amen. Well, as we always do, there's the number that you can text questions to during class. If you're online, it's on your online handout. So feel free to text questions during class. We are talking about Christianity, and in our last lesson we talked about the word Christianity has come to expand to cover an awful lot of things. And it's not my approach to say, well, that's Christian, that's not Christian, that is, that isn't, this person's in, this person's out. That's certainly not my place to do that. I do think what's productive, though, is let's ask the question, what is the essence of Christianity? What is Christianity about? What has it always been about? Sometimes we call that historic Orthodox Christianity. And to me, the best place to go to answer that question is the book of Romans. So if you remember from our last lesson, in this map, the Apostle Paul is taking off for between 53 and 57. He's making a big journey through what would then be called Asia, then into Greece. And when he comes to the city of Corinth, he's preaching the gospel there. And it's about 56 AD. And he hears that there are a group of believers in Rome, that a church, not a church, but a group of believers who meet at various houses and form a community, because they didn't have a church building at that time, but they have this group of believers, this congregation in Rome, and he hasn't been there. And so he writes to them, and you can see here in verse 15, he said, I am eager to, what are you eager to do? Am I eager to teach you theology? I'm eager to come and instruct you. He said, I'm actually eager to proclaim the gospel. The word preach has come to mean teaching you a lesson or giving you some oratory for a lesson, and it's a good thing. But in what its original sense is much more about proclaiming the good news. That's what preach the gospel means. I'm coming to tell you about something that has happened, an actual event whose importance is huge, and it's good news. This is not particularly religious language. I mean, it is now to us, but that's not religious language at the time. It says, I want to come tell you about something that's happened that is amazing news. And that's what he's saying. I want to come tell you about the amazing news. He said, for I am not ashamed of the good news, the gospel, for it is the power of God, this event, is the power of God to save everyone who believes, to the Jew first, also to the Greek. For in this event, the righteousness of God is being revealed from faith to faith. And just take that as the righteousness of God is revealed as being completely by faith. That is going to sound like bad news by the time we get to the end of this lesson, but it's actually very good news. So Paul wants to preach the gospel, the good news. The thing about the gospel is what it is basically intending to do. Try not to be too philosophical, but I want you to think about this. What this event does is it is an assertion of what our reality really is. The gospel is an assertion of what reality really is. And so as we go into this, I want you to keep that in mind. The gospel event is reordering, and it is making a big claim about you and me and our lives. So the very next verse, he begins the good news about this event by describing our current situation. He says, to understand this, you need to realize that the wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of people who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. For what can be known about God is plain to them because God has shown it to them. His invisible attributes, his eternal power, divine nature, these can be clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made. So people are without excuse. For although they know God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him, but they became futile in their thinking and their foolish hearts were darkened. So the key idea here is that the gospel wouldn't be necessary if we were okay. And the first claim of the good news is you are not okay. You are not in an okay relationship with God. You are not righteous, meaning you are not in harmony with God. You are estranged from God, from the very creator of the universe and your creator. We are not okay. And so there's an interesting corollary to that is it's pretty normal to not be okay. It's pretty normal to most of the people that you know are not okay in the sense that they are not at peace with God. And you'll see even more than that. So the wrath of God is revealed because people have rejected God. Specifically, and he goes on to say this, what has happened is, we talked about this in our last lesson, is all of us have made an exchange. In this passage of scripture, you'll see this three times. And because we have made this exchange, God has given us up or given us over, meaning allowed us to reap the rewards of the decision we have made. So it's not like, you know, your toddler comes in and says, I've decided I'm going to quit school. And you say, no, you're not, right? But in this case, we adults have made an exchange and turned our back on God, and God handed us over to the consequences of what we're doing. So here are the exchanges we've made. We exchanged the glory of God for idols, the truth for a lie, and God's good order for disorder. Claiming to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images, idols. Therefore, God gave them up to the desires of their hearts and its impurity, to the dishonoring of our bodies, because we exchanged the truth about God for a lie, and we worshiped and served creatures, usually ourselves, rather than the Creator. For this reason, God gave them up to dishonorable passions. For their women exchanged natural, read this, this is an interesting little word, and we talked about it a little last time, but read it as ordered, in the orderedness of creation, for those that are disordered, contrary to nature, not ordered. And the men likewise gave up natural relations, consumed with passion for one another. And since they did not see fit to acknowledge God, God gave them up to a debased mind to do what ought not to be done. They were filled with all manner of unrighteousness, evil, covetousness, and malice. So the fundamental claim of the gospel is we need this event because we are not okay and we are not in a right relationship with God. If we reject that idea, we reject the gospel. Without the wrath of God and a recognition that we are not reconciled to God, without that, there is no gospel. Now, there are people who want to take God's love for us, God's care for us, but want to reject the idea that God is wrathful at our rebellion, at our disobedience. That's not the gospel. I mean, you can believe whatever you want to believe, but the gospel begins with talking about we need what's happening. Okay, what this event was essential for us. I want to take you all the way back to Genesis because there's a bit of an undoing happening here. So you remember in Genesis, a couple of interesting things happened. So Genesis 1:1, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And the earth was without form, chaotic, and void, empty. And there was darkness on the face of the deep. So just pause there. What do you have in the beginning? You have no order, you have no sense, and you have no content, no meaning. You have chaos and no meaning. And so the act of creation of God is bringing order to the chaos and bringing meaning to the void. And so what does he do? He starts to bring order. And God said, let there be light. And there was light. And God separated the day and the night, creates the earth, separates the waters and the land. He begins to populate the land. You see what's happening? Creation is the story of God bringing order, good order, productive order, meaningful order into the world. And so it gets down to sixth day, and God said, let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them, humanity, have dominion over the fish and the birds, the livestock. In other words, we have this good ordered world. Let us create in our image humanity to have dominion, to have care over this world. So God created humanity in his own image, the image of God, he created him, male and female, he created them. And God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful, multiply, and fill the earth. Once again, this is God's MO, is go fill the void, fill it with meaning, fill it with people, with purpose. So be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it. Have dominion over everything. And it was so, and God saw that everything he had made, and behold, it was very good. So you remember as he's going through the days in creation, and I skip forward here, it's, you know, and God saw that it was good. And then he gets to the end and he creates humanity, and God saw that it was very good. So you have this sense of an orderedness, you have a sense of purpose, you have a sense of meaning and goodness about creation, and God says it is very good. Well, the gospel begins by saying things aren't good anymore. We aren't good anymore. Creation isn't good anymore. If everything was still this way, you don't need the gospel. You don't need Christ on the cross. You don't need resurrection. What has happened is we have made the exchange. We exchanged the glory of God to go worship idols, ourselves, pride, power, money, whatever it may manifest itself as. We have traded the truth that God is the one that deserves worship for a lie that we deserve worship. And finally, we have rejected the orderedness of God's creation, and we have disordered it. We have reordered it in our image. And so what you see out of this is God creates a good earth, and the exchange that we have made, the sin, the rebellion, whatever you want to call it, Romans casts it as this exchange we've made, has caused it not to be good anymore. It is not ordered. And then Romans 1:23-32, he goes on to describe what this disorderedness looked like. What does it look like when you make the exchange and God says, let this play out and see what happens? See if this sounds like meaning and purpose or orderedness. He said, they did not see fit to acknowledge God, so God gave them over to a debased mind to do what ought not to be done. They were filled with all manner of unrightness, evil, covetousness, greed, malice, full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, maliciousness. They are gossips, slanderers, haters of God, insolent, proud, haughty, boastful, inventors of evil, disobedience to parents, foolish, faithless, heartless, ruthless. I mean, think about that. It's got big things and it's got what we would consider little things. I mean, gossip is on that list. Slander, talking about people behind their back, is on that list. All of the things that you and I call sin are the disorderedness of having made that exchange. And I would like for you to think of sin that way, because all of a sudden you stop ranking sins. I'm not saying there aren't some sins that have greater consequences than others, but sometimes we think, well, I can understand why, you know, you might not be in good relationship with God, or maybe you'll go to hell if you're a mass murderer. But I can't really understand why little things that I do, you know, a little gossip here, a little few lies there, you know, how that makes a difference. It's a completely irrelevant way of looking at it. What Romans says is, I'm just putting all this out here as symptoms of the disorderedness. And so when we see those things in our lives, that is the result of having made an exchange. And so this is essentially the gospel. The beginning of the gospel story is talking about the implications of what we have done. So the great exchange, and this is important to think about, because I don't know that we think about it this way, it disordered us. And what I mean by that, we have what are called disordered desires. Debased mind, our foolish hearts were darkened. You know what that means is, we love things that weren't meant for us to love. We love things that were never meant for us to love. We have elevated good things to be best things. We've taken something that was good and we've made it an object of worship. And so our love, our passions, our desires have been bent by sin. We have been disordered. Our world has been disordered. In Romans 8, we'll get there in this series, it talks about how all of creation eagerly waits to be redeemed. Think about it this way: to be put back in order, to be given its structure again, to be taken out of chaos again. Creation is not the way it was intended to be. And our relationships. Obviously, our vertical relationship, by making that exchange, by rebelling against God, by saying, I'll be God, not you, by turning our back on God, we have broken that relationship. But the implication is that that disorderedness, that sin, breaks our horizontal relationships as well. I mean, think about what happens. Adam and Eve break their relationship with God by disobedience. God comes down and says, what have you done? And Adam says, she did it. Everything is broken from that point on. I mean, at that point, it's just go find a counselor. Wait, there are no counselors. Figure it out yourself, Adam and Eve, because you see the brokenness, disorderedness. I don't like the word broken as well as I like the word disordered, as you can tell, is that's happened to everything in our experience. Question.
So was creation made for man, or was man made to keep creation in order?
That's a good question. It's kind of like a chicken and egg thing just a little bit. It's clear that man's purpose was to care for and tend and have dominion. Dominion is not so much as I'm going to abuse things. I mean, I guess you could think about it that way, but dominion meant care for. I'm in charge of this and I'm going to steward it. I'm going to care for it. So the question is, was that made for man, or was man made for the creation? As in, God said, I want a garden. And you know what? This place is just, it's going to get overgrown. I gotta make something. I would argue the first, because if it's the latter, man is an afterthought. In other words, man is like, well, I need somebody to keep this place cleaned up. I need a caretaker. It seems to me from the text that man is given a mission and a purpose, and that humanity, the garden is made for humanity. The earth is made for humanity. So the way I read the text, it would indicate the latter. That's a good question.
If our vertical relationships are broken, and Paul is talking to Jews first and Gentiles second about wickedness, how did anyone reach heaven prior to Christ?
Good question. So I will probably like to answer that at the end of this lesson and the first of the next, but here's the short version so you don't think I'm ducking it. The scripture is going to teach that you were never saved by anything other than faith. So I'm just gonna leave that, and we will come back to that because we will have the context to talk about that later. But people were only ever saved by faith. So let's go on. So our world is not okay, we are not okay, and this is the beginning of the gospel story. But, so we get to the end of chapter one, and the chapters are artificial. So we get to the end of that, and you know you're thinking in your head, and Paul, by the way, knows you're thinking this. I'm sitting here thinking, but what about good people who live moral lives? Not everybody does all the stuff on that list, murder, envy, etc. Now, I'm not going to argue that I know anybody that's perfect, that never does anything on that list, but come on. What about just a good moral person? How can it be fair to condemn them when they are so much better than the people who do all the stuff on that list? Think of the Gandhis of the world. Think of the Dalai Lamas of the world. They at least can say, well, I didn't do most of the stuff on that list, and I have a moral framework. I have guidelines. We call this moralism. This, I told you about therapeutic deistic moralism, right? Deistic therapeutic moralism. This is the moralism part. And that is, I have a sense of morality. I behave in a way that is good. The shorthand is, I'm a good person. And consequently, I should go to heaven because I'm a good person. There are two huge problems with this. This is why the gospel is, he's about to answer this question because he knows it's in your mind. You read all that and you go, well, I'm not that bad. I'm a good person. I have an ethical system over here, so you can't be talking about me. That cannot be fair for me to be in that category. And probably everybody in America would say that. Probably very few people in America say, yep, you nailed it. I got 9 out of 10 of those things. You know, I've killed, I'm envy, I'm greedy, I'm prideful, etc. No, not many people are gonna say that, are they? They're gonna say, well, actually, I'm a pretty good person. I know there are a lot of bad people. I'll point them out to you if you want, God. But I'm pretty good. This is called moralism, is that my claim and my relationship with God is based on my morality. And so Paul is gonna answer this in just a second, but the answer is going to be no, you're not okay because of your morality. And you and I'm just going to reason with you on the first one, and then the second one, we're going to look at the scripture. But this should immediately pop into your head. The biggest problem with this idea that I'm a good person is whose morality? Whose morality are we talking about? So I'm going to give you several examples here. Let's start with the easy one. This is Sharia law. This is a caning about to happen. Sharia law. So let's say that you observe Sharia law. Sharia law is a moral code. You may or may not like it. You may or may not agree with it, but it's a moral code. It has right, it has wrong, it has people that are in, people that are out. Well, in America, we don't typically embrace Sharia law. It doesn't embrace the liberal Western values. I'm talking about non-Christians here, just most people say that doesn't fit, right? It's too harsh. But long story short, it's a morality. So you could be following Sharia law and say, I am a moral person. I am doing what my morality says. Who are you to tell me that my morality is wrong? In fact, I think you're an immoral person because you don't follow these guidelines. You understand what I'm saying? Let's move on. This is Dr. Peter Singer, still alive, Princeton, atheist, utilitarian by philosophical persuasion. He would argue he also has a morality. His morality is maybe a little different than yours. He believes that humans should not be valued any higher than other species. That's part of his morality, that animals have the same worth as humanity. He believes that euthanasia is very utilitarian. I mean, if you're old and you have no use to society, we might want to get rid of you. You're just not much use. You don't like it, but that's a morality. That's an ethical system. In fact, he would say to you, you are part of our problem because you don't have the guts to do what needs to be done to make this a harmonious society. How is it fair to the rest of us if you are using resources and contributing nothing? I know that isn't popular with you. I sure hope not that that's popular with you, but that's a morality, isn't it? He believes that personhood doesn't start until well after a child is born. So not only is Peter Singer come out in favor of abortion, Peter Singer doesn't think if you kill a one-year-old child, you are not killing a person. Do you understand what I'm saying? Okay, well, that's a morality. I'm going to say, you're wrong. He's going to say, no, actually, you're wrong. Do you understand the problem with moralism? Whose morality? Well, you're going to say, well, ours is obviously right. Well, guess what? Sharia law guy says, ours is obviously right. Singer goes, mine is obviously right. Hindu caste system. You have people that are locked into certain roles because of where they were born. I mean, it's kind of like, it's a little reminiscent of slavery in America, but it's still going on. I mean, it's you were born into this caste, that's what it is. You don't have certain rights or whatever. A Hindu might say to you, that's the way the world should be ordered. That's a good morality. And in fact, you guys got it all wrong. You're not very moral people. Finally, here's my favorite. This is very popular in America and the West. Look out for number one. If you don't, who will? In other words, you should do what's best for you. And that's a good morality. You should always ask, this is kind of a little Ayn Rand type thing for any of you fans out there, but this is kind of like the what is wrong with taking care of yourself. In fact, that is a very Darwinian idea. Yes, I need to take care of me. I'll take care of you if I have anything left over, but fundamentally, you are useful only insofar as you support my survival. And you say, well, that's just heinous. And they'd say, what are you talking about? That's the only real morality there is. I think you get the point, but I really want you to think about that. We look at the world from Western eyes and say, we judge everybody by our morality, don't we? Well, that's good. Well, that's really evil. But you know what? Everybody else is doing the same thing. That's why when you travel around the world to certain places, they don't just come up to you and say, you're an American? Thank you for teaching us the right way to live. We never knew how to do it before you Americans showed up. No, they're like, you proud Americans, you guys are such hypocrites. Your morality stinks. You know, you need to do things the way we want to do things. By the way, this is just an editorial comment. This is one of the fundamental issues with the West and China, because China thinks like that too. Like the world should admire China and its morality and its civilization, and China should lead the world by nature of its virtue. We don't share the same morality with traditional Chinese morality. And so what do you get? You get this. So the argument, the moralistic argument that says I'm a good person, well, which one of these people is a good person on this screen? Because they all think they are, and they all think you're not. So the biggest problem with moralism is you can't define what a good person is. And the Bible's going to suggest to you there are no good people. Now, the Bible's not trying to beat you down into the dust. It's just telling you the truth. There are no good people, because you know how the Bible values that? Are you in a good relationship with God? If you're not, you're not okay. So from a biblical point of view, moralism never measures up. First problem is, whose morality? Second problem is, and this is where Paul jumps in, beginning of chapter 2, he says, therefore, you have no excuse, O man, every one of you who judges. Now, here's how I want you to hear this. When he says judges, what I mean is this. I have my morality. I look at the rest of the world and I go, you're immoral. You're immoral. You're better than they are. You're not there yet. You do terrible things. That's just pure evil. What am I doing? I'm taking my morality and I'm using it as the standard for everybody else in the world. So is everybody else in the world. So he's actually talking to all the moralists in the world who are counting on our morality. He said, oh, every one of you who judges, in passing judgment on another, you condemn yourself. because you, the judge, practice the very same things. In other words, what he's saying is, we are all hypocrites. We are all hypocrites. He's saying, first of all, you can't decide whose morality is right, but second of all, each of you is judging everybody else by your morality, and the problem is, you can't even live up to your own morality. That's Paul's bold claim, is that if you say you're a good person, God could come to you and me today and say, no problem, I'm going to judge you by your own standards. How many of us honestly think that we could meet our own ethical standards? No one. None of us have lived up perfectly to our own ethical standards. So Paul says, you're hypocrites, meaning you're fooling yourself. He says, we know that the judgment of God rightly falls on those who do these things. Do you suppose, you who judge those who practice such things and do them yourself, that you will escape the judgment of God? In other words, how can you be honest and say, my morals are going to save me, my morals commend me to God, when the person whose morals are the opposite of yours is saying the same thing? And then secondly, even if that were true, I can't pass being judged by my own moral system. Not one of us is capable of following their own moral system. And so what Paul is saying here is, moralism won't get you there. He says, all have sinned without the law. When you see the word the law, here's how I want you to think about it. He's talking about the law of Moses, but he's talking in a broader sense about a code of conduct. Any code of conduct. In other words, no code of conduct, whether it's the law of Moses, it's Sharia law, it's Peter Singer, it's the secularist, it doesn't matter. No code of conduct will get you to God. He said, those who sin without a code of conduct perish without it, but those who sin under their code of conduct will be judged by their code of conduct. For it is not the hearers of the law who are righteous, but the doers who will be justified. So what do we really normally do? Here's the way moralism works. Either you're a total heathen and you do all those things, in which case we all agree, yeah, God, I have no issue with you dealing harshly and your wrath being on those people. But I don't want your wrath to be on me because I'm a moral person. And don't listen to all those other people. My morality is the best morality, okay? But I realize that I don't keep even my own morality perfectly, so you know what we all do? We grade on the curve. We do, don't we? That we grade on the curve. And guess who sets the curve? Me. Who passes? Me and anybody above. Who fails? Anybody right below me. And what if I do this? I just grade on the curve, right? That's how we rationalize it. It's been said that man is the rationalizing animal, and that is very, very true. We do like to fool ourselves. We kid ourselves. And so moralism can never get us there. But there's one more objection. So you're listening to all of this, and let's say you're a Christian or you're a Jew, and you know the commands of God, and you try to keep the commands of God. Jews, particularly at that time, would have said this, but wait a minute, I'm a religious person. I do acknowledge God. I haven't made the exchange to worship an idol. I acknowledge God. The Jews definitely thought this. This is a quote from the Mishnah. The Mishnah is a short version of this. I think we talked about it before, but all the Jews at that time knew this. So when Moses goes up onto Mount Sinai and he gets the Torah, so the first five books of the Bible, 613 commands. 10 of them are the most famous, but there's 613 commands, and he gives them, and that's called the Torah, the law, the written law. So, but while he's up there, he also gets the oral law that God tells him, and it's not supposed to be written down. It is memorized from generation to generation. And along with it, and that's called the Mishnah. And so along with this oral law, there's all of this debating and talking about it. And so you end up with this body of traditions to go along with the law of Moses. You know about this because everything Jesus clashed with the Pharisees about was about that, about the oral law. He never clashed with them about the written law. Jesus didn't break the written law, but he did break their traditions. And so they thought that Moses had given certain laws. Now you're probably thinking to yourself, Terry, if it's the oral law, how did it get written down? Good question. So think about around the time of Jesus, people know this. Well, Pharisees know this, and they're pretty happy to tell everybody else. Okay, so the Mishnah's got all kinds of little rules. Here's a great example. In the Torah, it says, remember the Sabbath and keep it holy. Don't do any work on the Sabbath. Well, in the oral law, it defines that a little bit. And then they made even more traditions. So you can only walk a certain distance on the Sabbath. That's not in the law of Moses, but that was in the oral law, the traditions that you could only walk a certain distance. It gets so minute that in the Mishnah, for example, it says that if a beggar comes to your door on the Sabbath and he holds his cup out and asks for something, if you take a coin and reach outside your door and drop it in, you have violated the Sabbath. But if he takes his bowl and puts it inside and you drop a coin in without your hand leaving your house, he has violated the Sabbath, but you have not. So, I mean, it gets extremely detailed. Well, one of the big things that's in the Mishnah is in the section is called Sanhedrin, chapter 10, verse 1. All Israel has a share in the world to come. And what that basically means is all Jews go to heaven. Everybody who's part of Israel goes to heaven. Why? Because Abraham had faith. He's got this big old reservoir of faith. And we all get to tap into it. And so Abraham is our father. Our great, 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 great father, right? Jesus said, remember, even John the Baptist said, now don't think saying that our father is Abraham is going to make you right with God. Paul is later going to say, and I'll show you in a second, that a Jew being right with God doesn't come from your ethnicity. And that really was earth-shattering to them. They thought, I'm righteous because I'm a Jew. I'm descended from Abraham. And consequently, you got to let me in. It's sort of like being a legacy pledge. You know, if you pledge a sorority or a fraternity, well, you got to let me in. You know, I've got five brothers and sisters that have all been, you know, in this fraternity or sorority. You have to let me in. Well, that's what they thought. And that's what the Mishnah told them. So what Paul is saying, though, is really going against that. He says, if you call yourself a Jew and you rely on the law and boast in God, and know his will and approve what is excellent because you are instructed from the law, if you're sure that you're a guide to the blind, a light to those who are in darkness, an instructor to the foolish, a teacher of children, having in the law the embodiment of knowledge and truth, you then who teach others, do you not teach yourself? While you preach against stealing, do you steal? The Pharisees did. The Pharisees did a lot of dishonest things to get money. And that's part of the reason they really weren't happy with Jesus. Because Jesus is going to say to them, what he's saying is, you say you're religious people, but you don't keep the rules. You're no better than the moralist because you've got God's rules, but you can't stand under being judged by God's rules because we are disordered. We love money, for example, in the Pharisees. As much as you think you love God, you actually also love money. And Jesus sparred with them several times about dishonest things they did. That's why he said to them, you Pharisees are like whitewashed tombs. You look good on the outside, but inside you're dead. Meaning you do all the right stuff, but you have neglected, here's another quote, the greater things of the law, mercy and justice. And so this idea of I'm going through the motions and consequently I'm good, and Jesus saying, you won't stand up to being judged by God's law. You're no better off than the moralist. All you have is you have a better moral system. I mean, at least you have God's rules and not your rules, right? Or Sharia law or something else. But you can't stand up to that either. So he goes on, he says, those of you who boast in the law dishonor God by breaking the law. For it is written, the name of God is blasphemed among the Gentiles because of you. You also. So he's now talked to people that should know there's a God. These are people like, people ask me a lot of times, what about people who have never heard about Jesus? Romans 1. You still know there's a God, and yet you have made this exchange. You've exchanged God and you worship something else. No one's going to be able to deny that. You worship something else. Oh, I'm a good moral person. I know. And you know what? Your morality is no better than anybody else's morality. And secondly, you can't even live up to your own standards. Well, but I'm a religious person. Well, you definitely can't live up to God's standards, or you aren't living up to God's standards. So Paul's going to go through all of this, and he's going to come to this final conclusion, and he really nails the Jew. He says, "For no one is a Jew who is merely one outwardly, nor is circumcision outward and physical, but a Jew is one inwardly. Circumcision is a matter of the heart, by the spirit, not by the letter. His praise is not from man, but from God." The greatest commandment, Jesus says, of the 613 is found in Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 4. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. It doesn't say, be strictly perfect in your obedience in everything. Now, that's good, but that's not the greatest commandment, isn't it? The greatest commandment is a commandment of wholeheartedness. Why would it be wholeheartedness? Because that is bringing order out of disorderedness. Remember when I said that we are disordered, it's because our loves, our desires, our passions are not toward the things they ought to be. What is that commandment saying? Reorient your heart to let God, with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, be the number one thing. It's sort of like wandering around in the woods and somebody gives you a compass and all of a sudden you are oriented. You know where to go. That's what that command does. It says, you've been worshiping a lot of stuff. Let me make this simple. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. That's orienting, ordering our lives. That commandment is there for a reason. So the standard of this is not behavior. It has more to do with the orientation of our heart. Paul goes on. Now we know that whatever the law says, it speaks to those who are under the law, so that every mouth may be stopped and the whole world may be held accountable to God. For by works of the law, and I want you to think about that, by any code of conduct, no human being will be justified before God, since through this code of conduct comes knowledge of sin. In other words, what he's saying is this. He's not just talking about the law of Moses, he is, but he's not just talking about that. He says any moral system, the best it can do is simply make you aware of what you shouldn't do, and you still do. Does that make sense? Any moral system. This is why moralism fails. You can say, yeah, but my neighbor is just an awesome person. Yeah, they do really well. I've always said, this is going to sound a little harsh to you, but you know, there are just going to be some people in hell are going to be better behaved than others. Because that's not the point, is it? The best that any code of conduct can do is to show you how it falls short. That's true of the law of Moses. That's true of any moral system. So you ask yourself then, what hope do we possibly have? Paul has reached the end of his point. Chapters 1 through most of 3 is simply this. I have good news for you. And this good news is the power to save you, to rescue. The word save is often translated rescue. To rescue you, to reconcile you to God. He said, this is the good news. And here's how it starts. You're not okay. You have a terminal disease called sin. The wrath of God is on us because we are alienated from God. We have made a great exchange that has led us to turn away from God and worship other things. And it has disordered us and the world and all of our relationships. And our moralities that we then push forward to try to make the world a better place. Well, first of all, it's all relative. Whose morality is it? And secondly, you don't even keep your own morality. If we did, don't you think this world would be running a little better than it is? I mean, not many people's morality would justify what's happening when you read the newspaper. And yet it does. Morality doesn't work. It simply won't get you there. And Religion doesn't work. All religion can do is convict you that you don't measure up to God. So he starts, and his whole point is to make this seem hopeless. What can I do? And here's the interesting question, because if you're this in Acts chapter 2, by the way, right after the day of Pentecost, right, Holy Spirit comes, speak in tongues, people come over and go, what is going on? Peter stands up and he gives this great sermon, and he basically says, this Jesus whom you crucified, God has made both Christ and Lord, and he raised him from the dead. And it says they were cut to the heart. They were convicted like, oh no. And they were basically thinking, what hope do we have? And they said this, brothers, what can we do? And that's where you have to be before the gospel is really good news, is the recognition that my morality won't get it there, my code of conduct won't get me there, that I have fundamentally set my heart and my desires on things that were not intended to be the object of my heart and desire and worship. And when you get there, you get this sense of hopelessness. Well, how then can anyone be saved? How is it possible to be reconciled to God? And that's Paul's first point. That's the beginning of the good news, is to understand that without the good news, I have no hope. If you don't get that in whatever gospel you're preaching, you don't have a gospel. You've just got gossip. I heard Jesus died on the cross, loves me tremendously, raised from the dead. That's awesome. I'll let you know if I need it. Seriously, I'll let you know if I need it. That's moralistic, therapeutic deism. Remember the tenets? I'm a good person. God surely just wants me to be nice to everybody else and be happy. And if I'm a good person, I'll go to heaven. Where do you see the cross and the resurrection in that? Nowhere. Don't need it. You see what I'm saying? Don't need it. Because you don't think that you have no hope without it. So Paul concludes it. So this is the conclusion. He says, but now the righteousness of God, meaning being reconciled to God, being considered innocent before God. This word righteousness gets defined a lot of ways. It's a little bit of a juridical term, like righteous means not guilty. You've been declared not. You are guilty, but you've been declared not guilty, right? Somebody's paid your price. You know, you get the idea of the gospel in that sense. That's good. But basically what he's saying is he bookends it. In chapter 1, verse 18, the wrath of God is being revealed against all ungodliness and unrighteousness. And you're thinking, that would be terrible for those people. And Paul goes on and says, you're those people, right? All of us are those people. So now he turns and he says, but in answer to the question, what hope do I have? The righteousness of God has been manifested, has been revealed completely apart from a code of conduct. You know, I'm talking about, it's apart from the law of Moses. I mean, the law of Moses won't save you, but apart from that, but apart from your morality, which cannot save you, apart from any code of conduct, which cannot save you. Righteousness has been revealed apart from that. The righteousness of God comes through faith in Jesus Christ for all who believe. So I want to just tell you this now, because I've said this before, but in case you haven't been in any of our classes, these words all translate the same word for believe and faith. Believe and faith, the same word in Greek. They're the same word. And we translate them all these ways. My preference is trust, because the sense of the original language is best captured by trust, not believe. Believe to us, I mean, it means believe, but it means more than just mental assent. That's not what the text means. I'll say trust a lot, because when I say trust, you go, oh, that's not just mental assent. My heart's involved in trust. That's a good translation. So I'm not criticizing it. I just want you to know, I'm gonna use all those words interchangeably. So what's he saying? He's saying, well, how then can anybody be saved? Well, you can't by your code of conduct. But God has revealed, remember, God did this, not us. There is nothing you can do to be saved. That's, you got to think about that a little bit, and you can challenge me if you want to, but the answer is, what can I do to be saved? There is nothing you can do to be saved. You don't have the power to be saved, but God has the power to save you. And so God has revealed a righteousness apart from any code of conduct you might have, and it's available through faith in Jesus Christ, and it's available to everyone who places their trust in Christ. There's no distinction because everyone has sinned, everyone has fallen short of the glory of God, and everybody who is going to be saved will be justified by His grace as a gift. Salvation is a gift God gives you, not something that we live up to or earn. This is the most important idea. It will completely change your life. It will completely change the way you live your life. When we understand that the gospel is the good news that you cannot save yourself, your morality won't do it, your religion won't do it, but God has made a way through faith in Jesus Christ because of what He did. Period. That is how you are saved. Place your trust in what Jesus Christ has done. And we'll talk about ideas about redemption and other ideas, but this is the good news, is that God has accomplished what we could not accomplish. Now, I want you to let that soak in, because next lesson, I want you to come back with your but, bring your but questions. But that's too easy. But wait a minute, does that mean I can behave any way I want? But bring all your but questions with you. I really want you to sit with this and think about it, because I want to drill all the way down, because by the end of this, I really want us to understand that is the good news, and it really, really will change everything about the way you live. It takes a load off of your shoulders, because I know that we as Christians know I'm saved by grace through faith, Ephesians 2:8, that salvation is a gift from God because of what Jesus Christ did, not because of what I did. But from here to here, it gets short-circuited in this, the busyness of life, doesn't it? And here knows that there's nothing I can do to earn salvation. But here continues to say, you're not doing very well. You try a little harder. Aren't you a little ashamed of that? You better work a little bit harder at this, because surely, you know, come on, you're a Christian. You're supposed to act different. You're supposed to act better than this, right? Does this happen to you guys? Well, just consider this group therapy for me then. That happens, right? What we know here and what we experience here aren't always in sync, are they? And that's okay. That's part of the Christian life. It's not like I've decided to place my trust in Christ and a switch flips and everything in your life is reordered and you're now back in the Garden of Eden. It's a process of the Spirit working in us to Romans 8, that we would be conformed to the very image of Jesus Christ. Scripture calls that sanctification, making us holy. That doesn't happen until you say, all right, I surrender. I'll surrender my moral code. I'll surrender everything I was trying to do to get right with God. I'm going to put everything in me, my heart, mind, soul, and strength, completely put all my chips on Jesus Christ. I'm putting all my trust in Him. I'm following Him. I'm going to be just like Him, because that's the way to be saved, not anything that I'm going to do. When that sinks all the way into our hearts, you will be so much less stressed. And we will treat the things that happen to us so very differently. We will stop doubting, am I saved, am I not? Am I good enough, am I not? It will reflect itself, and God begins to reorder everything. He reorders us, our hearts, our desires. He will reorder the world through us, and He will reorder all of our relationships. So I want you to take this, I want you to meditate on it, I want you to think about it, the idea that there is nothing you and I can do to save ourselves. But reconciliation with God has been made possible by something Jesus Christ did. It is a gift, and it is available to everyone who placed their trust in Jesus Christ, period. That's the good news. Now go home and come up with your butt questions. I'll see you next week.